Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The first project that I ever had in anthropology as a postdoc was in 1974 together with my wife, and it was called Crisis, Culture, and Identity, and nobody would fund it. In those days, there were no problems, of that kind at least, not for anthropologists. But we proceeded to write, and we tried to get together with different fields and other, let's say, social scientists dealing with the contemporary, and nobody would have anything to do with it, and so we ended up talking to archaeologists and historians and some geographers. And that became what we call today global systemic anthropology, which began in the 1970s, 73, 74, with an article called Why Society Doesn't Work, which applies to today pretty clearly, it seems to me. But in those days, it was impossible. And we published a whole lot of things on crisis and on decline and on shifting hegemonies and so on and so forth, and nobody believed any of it until pretty recently, when suddenly it's gotten very popular, and we've been asked to write all kinds of articles and journals and have debates and so on and so forth. And a friend of mine who's a lawyer up in San Francisco, who was actually one of the lawyers who fixed the papers for all of the Chinese who work in Silicon Valley, high-end, in other words, high-end immigration, called me on the phone, and he screamed, "Friedman, you're finally right." And that was last November, okay? A part of what I want to say is a self-advertisement, but it's not really for me. It's for all the people who have been working in this direction. I would say simply Bredelian, long-term historical processes, that what's going on today shouldn't be a shock. It's happened many times before, and it's probably going to happen again. I would go even further and say that if we have a dark age at the end of it, we shouldn't be shocked by that either, because that's also happened before. Not quite as often, but if you look around carefully, you'll find plenty of examples. The kind of anthropology, then, we do is historical. It is interested in political economy. It is focused very much on the systemic aspects of global interaction, global arrangements, and globalization, as it is called, which is something that developed in the mid-80s, in fact, as in terminological sense, is an aspect of that. It is not an evolutionary phenomenon. It is something which occurs in certain phases, usually, as Braudel put it, at the end of hegemonies. That's when things go global. Even though the global is always there, but globalization as such is essentially an end of empire kind of phenomenon. When you get a decentralization of accumulation in the world, you get movements because of crisis, of people, of things. You have also a rapid diffusion of cultural models, usually from old centers to new centers. You get a whole series of phenomena which can be documented even for the period which occurred between 1880 and 1920, which was also a period of massive globalization, massive crisis, massive financialization. Hilferding, of course, the famous German economist, wrote Das Finanzkapital right in the middle of this period, and people who talk about financialization today don't ever refer to him, except if they're really into that kind of stuff. But a very similar phenomena occurred. There was also mass migration. There were plenty of problems. The word multiculturalism and transnationalism was first, as far as I can find, used in the Atlantic Monthly in 1916, and it was a fairly common part of discussions in those days. The article is called Transnational America. I forget the Rudolph something or other, I forget his name, who wrote it, who's disappeared. Exactly, Randolph Bourne. An extremely interesting article because it says almost identical things to the things that appear later. And then there's, of course, the whole literature on plural society from the colonial period, which has arisen again in slightly new forms with basically the same kinds of content. Okay, all of that is just to introduce the kind of issues that we've dealt with. What I would like to discuss here is a certain understanding that we have tried to develop of what is happening right now. This is supposed to be about the 21st century. This is not the era of the 21st century. It's not an era. We're not in anything evolutionary. Again, I'm very much against any evolutionary approaches to globalization. Globalization is not something that has never occurred before. It is also something that disappears. So I could begin by stating something which has already been discussed by other people, that if 1880 to 1918 is a period of massive globalization, in the mid-20s, it begins to reverse rapidly. There is a period of deglobalization, which continues through World War II and doesn't take up again until the early 50s and becomes massive by the end of the 50s in terms of the export of capital and all the other things that are associated with globalization. And it could be coming to an end again pretty soon. If one looks at least in economic terms, there is a tendency today for the regions of the world, the large regions, let's say APEC, NAFTA, and the EU, to become increasingly self-centered in terms of both consumption and especially investment, which would be closer to the vision, if it turns out to be competitive, which it probably will, something closer to the vision of Orwell, who also had three massive units which were in competition with one another. So maybe we're going in that direction instead of towards increasing contact, globalization, and fun, which is how globalization was also looked at in the early years. It doesn't look like fun to me, and I don't think it was ever a whole lot of fun for the people who were the objects of the globalizing process itself. okay. To discuss this, I have some graphs, which always make things a lot simpler. Generally speaking, since this is, again, this is very informal, okay? You can stop me whenever you want, and we can discuss everything. I want to discuss a number of trends of which the present crisis is an aspect, you could say, the present economic crisis, you could say, which is not simply an American crisis, it's a European, it's a Western world crisis. It is not the same kind of crisis in China. Their big problem is us as consumers. But it's not an economic crisis in that part of the world of the same order. Not true in India either. And of course, there's a new emergent bloc of countries called the BRIC, which are rapidly taking on increasing hegemonic functions in the world, especially at Davos in the new meetings where they are represented en masse and which they are making statements which clearly represent, from an outside point of view, a shift in decision-making power in the world, which is to be expected, it seems to me. I'll start with the general idea in relationship to the notion of globalization, and that is simply this, that globalization is a phase phenomena. It doesn't mean that there's nothing global in before or after. Globalization is something that occurs within global systems. And it is a period of transfer of wealth, decentralization of wealth, in which usually have enormous great instability. There's a fragmentation, you could say, of a formerly centralized, more or less centralized situation, which is the situation of hegemony, which doesn't necessarily have to take the form of empire, but it has lots of this of similar qualities, you could say. And that this can be exemplified. Can be exemplified by the kinds of phenomena that are discussed by people like Arrighi, who is probably the best at that. He's the Picasso of world systems theory, or was, in his several books on the long 20th century and others. I don't know if that's visible. Can I make it bigger? Which is simply an argument that the history of Europe is simply a history of shifting hegemonies, beginning in the Mediterranean, moving to the Iberian Peninsula, then towards Holland, and then to England. But there are more specific aspects of this which are extremely important, such as, for example, the fact that industrialization, as in the Industrial Revolution, was financed to the tune of almost 40% by foreign capital. It wouldn't have happened, in other words, if England had to do it all by itself, which means that these connections are central to all of this. And, of course, we're up to, let's say, after the United States, we're up to China today, and the question is how long it's going to last. And the other aspect of this is that this all fits into a larger curve, and these are curves of what we refer to today as civilizational cycles, which are longer, long cycles, longer than hegemonic cycles, and which usually end with gigantic collapses of one kind or another, which can take many, many years. They're a slow fizzling out. The Roman Empire was at the end of one of these cycles as well and led into a dark age. And, of course, for the people who would like to see it in ecological terms, one could say that there are ecological limits to these systems as a whole, which usually expand, become intensified, so that you get more and more actors involved, and then you have a problem of resources and the costs of maintaining the expansion itself, which usually leads to increasing conflicts and so on and so forth, and then some kind of a major collapse, which is, I think, a possibility today. In statistical terms, I would say it's more possible today than it was 60 years ago, at least, or 40 years ago, and for reasons which fit very much the system of the systematic aspects of this kind of a model. Now, this could be all wrong, but we have been working on it and trying to demonstrate to what extent it might make sense. Applied to an earlier period, you have this is the period from, you could say, the takeoff of the Athenian Empire to the end of the Roman Empire, which I think can be fit into the same kind of a process. There is also much more to this, of course. In other words, the decline of Athens had to do very much with the export of its entire productive apparatus to the north, leading to the Macedonian expansion, but also to expansions in other parts of southern Europe, and also to the Middle East, where many of the productive activities moved, in a period when Athens was very wealthy, exporting the products of its own exported production, by and large, let's say shifting from a situation where it was a world's workshop to a world's consumer. And it's interesting that Weber's ideology of pre-industrial cities applies extremely well to the ends of empire. But if he were to look at Athens at the beginning, or Rome as a republic, he would find that they were industrial cities that were the major exporters of their periods. So his model doesn't really fit as a general classification. And for, I would say, very good reasons that apply very much today. The United States is becoming very much like Rome. In the recent discussions, for example, when the president gets up and says, we've got to start producing, and people say, what? And who are we going to sell it to? And how? And so on and so forth, after we've already exported a large percentage of what was once produced in this country, which is a central aspect of imperial order, imperial rule, hegemonic control. There are lots of examples that I love to talk about in all of this. One of them is that Rome was a slave society. Rome was, to some extent, a slave society, but it also was a wage labor society. Athens has often been referred to also as a slave society because the Republic of Free Men was only 20% of the population. But if you look at the slaves, they all were paid. Athens was more commercialized than even the United States in many ways because the slaves were owned by slave owners who rented them out on a manpower basis, you could say, to the silver mines and to other operations. Sometimes they were handicraft workers. If they were handicraft workers, they produced stuff that they sold on the market and paid an interest or a rent to their owners. So you had an entirely commercialized set of relationships, which is confused with the notion of slavery simply because these people were, quote, unfree. That says something about what's happening today. In other words, what is manpower about as an organization? The world's largest employer is very similar to what went on in Greece in many ways. So these kinds of things interest the group of people that I work with. Another example are the revolts that occur. For example, in the latter part of the Hellenistic period, there is a governor of Sparta who wants to go socialist. And he says, we have to return to our roots. Well, he's doing it in those terms. Our roots are egalitarian. There should be no private property. Everyone should be equal, and so on and so forth. And, of course, it didn't work because the peasants that he was telling this to were interested mostly in killing their landlords and getting their private property to themselves, which is what happened, in fact. So it didn't work out very well, and one could look at other revolutions and ask if that isn't what very often happens. So there are similarities that are striking and I think important to understand. Double-entry bookkeeping is another example. It goes way the hell back to the Bronze Age. So we are talking about a world, I think, which has properties which are comparable to the world that we're living in and which end in very similar ways. The Bronze Age collapse of 1200 BC is quite similar to the phenomena that I think we can talk about today, a period in which you have a set of hegemonic shifts, increasing competition, production increases tremendously in the 14th and 13th centuries, and which leads to a virtually total collapse in Greece, in the Middle East, and in Egypt, simultaneously over a period of about 70 years, and which brings on, you could say, one of the other Dark Ages, which is quite well known between 1200 and 700 BC. And there isn't a new takeoff there. There's one in the Middle East, in Assyria, and then there's one in Greece itself. But there is a period when there is a real decline in technology, in written language, in a whole series of areas which then begin to take off again in a later period. So these are the kind of phenomena that I think are interesting to look at. And that is, you could say, the more political, economic, materialist side of the whole thing. And this, of course, is connected directly to people's lives. And as an anthropologist, that is my, you could say, final destination. How do all these things connect into social life, into cultural production, into the kinds of things that people do in the midst of all of these processes? In order to get at that, I want to try to give a few examples, and this is from some of the older stuff that we've done. But before doing that, I want to say a couple of things about the current crisis, just to get rid of all this material stuff. When I was in San Diego last year, the crisis began to loom in the university. And, of course, the crisis was being talked about all over the country. And everybody was blaming somebody. It was the bankers. It was Bush. Then it was Obama, depending on what network you watch. And there was an incredible polarization that went on around these issues. And an awful lot of magical thinking, I think, as well. I did a whole lot of interviews with people who talked about the problem is that there are too many dumb people in this country. And these were the people who didn't like Republicans, and that they shouldn't be allowed to vote. I actually have people saying that people who are that stupid should not be allowed to vote. And I said, what about democracy, though? It doesn't matter. Some things are more important. And this isn't funny because in Europe, this is institutionalized. And I'll get back to that in a few minutes, I hope, because it's one of the aspects of what I want to talk about. If one looks at the trends involved, there are people who have been writing about this for a long time. There are interesting paradoxes. Paul Krugman gets the Nobel Prize. Not the Nobel Prize. It's not the Nobel Prize. It's the Swedish National Bank Prize. Nobel would have nothing to do with it, in fact, if he were alive today. And the National Bank Prize blows with the wind. So for years, they gave the prizes to what we call liberals, or neoliberals, if you want to call them that. I'm not sure what that word means. Like Milton Friedman and so on and so forth. And now suddenly, Krugman gets the prize, just after the crisis hits the fan, as they say, and suddenly there's a kind of Keynesian blossoming in Sweden, and everybody talks about it, but the economists don't really want him, in fact. And I know the discussion because my daughter is on the National Bank board, and there was quite a lively discussion about the whole thing. But Krugman, since then, has been writing in the newspaper, would love to be in the government, but people are a little nervous about him. And if you look at his book, Depression Economics, you might be able to find out why. Even though he's a very smart man, of course, after all, he's got the prize. The book Depression Economics and the Return of Depression Economics, two books which are extremely good, and he was ahead of his time in seeing that something bad was happening, he never once mentions the word debt. It's not in the index. It's not in the book. I've scanned it. There's no such thing as debt for his kind of Keynesianism because, as after World War II, he claims, the United States simply produced itself out of the debt. Fat chance you can do that today. And the United States didn't do that, of course. And if they did do that, it was because of the Marshall Plan and because of captive markets and so on and so forth. It was because of the imperial power of the United States. And when that stopped working, they started issuing euro dollars and all kinds of other means to prop up the American economy when they were already moving out large amounts of their capital. Some of the people that I know have worked on this, when I went home, everybody in Paris, where I work, had to have a course on crisis. So I had a course on crisis, and I invited economists, and two of the economists who happen to know, who have written actually a book called Capital Resurgent, which is published by Harvard for some reason, but they published Empire also. These are two Marxists, but also standard economists. Let's say they know their math. Their names are Dumini and Levy, very famous book. In fact, Harvey stole most of their stuff for his own book on neoliberalism. Of course, they claim basically that what happened in the 80s was not about neoliberalism, it was about class relationships. It was about an attempt by the upper class or the capitalist class to regain the power that they had lost from the late 50s on, and which can be shown in terms of income distribution, which fits very nicely, and they do a very kind of hard analysis of all this, as if you look at the share of total wealth held by the top 1%, that it's in the 80s that everything shifts back towards where it was supposed to be. Okay, so there is definitely a transfer of wealth in those terms. And what they discover in this quite empirical book is that that transfer of wealth is not to industrial capitalists, it's to the financial capitalists, and there's an enormous great you could say financialization, as it's called, in this period. Capital becomes the dominant branch of capital and the most important form of accumulation. And this was not the fault of neoliberalism in general. Neoliberalism is, to some extent, an expression of this because there was a lot of deregulation that made this go on more quickly than it would have gone on in any case. But it happened everywhere. It happened in more state-controlled economies like France, at the same rate as it did in the United States, just that people don't talk about it there in the same way. But it was happening, and it has happened. In a country like Sweden, where I live and have done a lot of research, the Gini Index between 1990 and 1993 or 93-94 went up by, went up or down, or however you want to look at it, went up by 23% to 25%, which is a world record, and Swedes love to have world records. That's to say, the level of stratification went up by something like 25%. The difference between the upper 10% and the lower 10% went up by that much, which hasn't happened for a very long time. Sweden has always been called the most egalitarian society in the Western world, no longer, although they're still pretty good. But so this is a general phenomenon. There is something else going on in all of this, which has to do with the nature of the global system itself, which I've already referred to, and that is that the U.S. and then Europe is exporting massive amounts of productive capital in the form of direct investment all over the world, not least to East Asia and to South Asia. And if one looks at the rate of accumulation in Europe and the United States, you can see the reflection of that. That's to say that accumulation at home is declining. Accumulation is being transferred to other parts of the world. And if you look at the last 10 years of accumulation, over 60% of the increase of gross domestic products, the increase, I'm not saying the actual quantities, but the increases have been coming from the BRIC countries and some other so-called newly developing countries. And where the old world including the United States, has been declining. So we are, not to say this part of the world is losing out in terms of its share of the growth or the economic growth of the world. So these are simply facts, as I see it. There are things that could be argued about, but these are things that are actually happening. There's a kind of emptying out that's been going on and a transfer, and this is what happens in Weber's industrial cities, that you become an importer of your own formerly exported capital. This can be shown, and this is like, I started doing this quite some years ago, but I love these pictures. Actually, you can watch the debt every second now, because there's a debt clock, and there's a global debt clock that The Economist has on the net now, so you can watch the world debt increase. So this is all very interesting, and you can see that the debt of the United States has been increasing very rapidly, and it's still doing that. And it has nothing to do with George W. Bush. It has to do with the way the economy works. In fact, Clinton did his share, a very big share, in fact. He's the man who opened up, you could say, very much of the financialization process itself. So neoliberalism is not a product of republicanism, not any more than liberal means having a strong state, which it does in the United States for some reason. I'm not sure why. Certainly is not the case in Europe. Another example of this is to compare this simply to what's going on in China at the same time. And just to give you a very simple example of this, this is in French, sorry, but you can get used to it. This is the percentage, this is in the year 2000, okay, so it was already there. This is the percentage of products, world products, being produced in China. 83% of the world's tractors, 75% of the watches and clocks, 70% of the toys, we all know about that, 60% of the penicillin, I didn't know about that, 55% of the cameras, 50% of the vitamin C. This is portable computers, which today is 75% because China now owns IBM laptops. They've already been producing them for quite some time. Telephones, 50%. This is air conditioners. Televisions has also gone up to 50%, and so on and so forth. And, of course, they have to import an awful lot of raw materials to get this. So the Chinese, of course, are colonizing Africa in the same way that Europe did. Large-scale infrastructure projects, for example, in Angola, railroad projects that basically bring the raw materials to the port, just like the Europeans did in the 19th century. In South America, very similar kinds of things are going on, and it's on a very large scale. This is not small stuff. It's very big stuff, and it's happening extremely rapidly. In Tibet, for example, the Chinese want Tibet not for ideological reasons, but because Tibet is where all the rivers start. That is the major source of water power in East Asia. And they're in the process of channeling many of the rivers, and one plan is for the entire Irrawaddy to be channeled into China instead of going down into Burma. The Salween is already in process, which runs into the same area, splits into Thailand and Burma, which means there's going to be a catastrophe in those areas if it gets done. And the Chinese are very effective, so it's going to get done. These are major shifts. We're talking about the rise of a new hegemonic power. Now, everyone would agree, I think, today, a lot of people agree, that this is happening. But we were talking about this quite some time ago. So I'm just trying to say that this is stuff that could have been predicted. It could have been understood. Quite early on. All right, what happens in periods like this? In this part of the world, there's a decentralization process. There's a weakening of the state. Already back in the 70s, people were talking about the bankruptcy of European states who couldn't afford to maintain their programs and things like that, and there were several waves of this decline. This is also the period, the 1970s, when you begin to get cultural fragmentation in Europe. In the 1950s, political scientists and ethnic studies people wrote about the disappearance of ethnicity in Europe, especially, you could say, regional ethnicity, migrant ethnicity. We talked about the hyphenated identities that were going to disappear in the United States. All these people ran into a dead end in the early 70s, and Esman, who's very well known in this area, wrote a book on the rise of the new ethnicities in which he said, whoops, we must have made a mistake, because they were working with trends. And in the 70s, those trends reversed themselves very quickly. The best example is France, because France had the most centralized cultural model of any country in Europe, strongly assimilationist. It forbade one language after another, the whole south of France, Brittany, and so on and so forth, and made French the absolute, let's say, standard Parisian French, or whatever you want to call it, with the Académie Française as the basic form of communication. And people had to learn it, and there was no question about it. And in the 1970s, that started to fall apart in the form of social movements and cultural movements. The Mouvement Occitaniste, which got very violent quite early, and which people don't write about, but is there very strongly and very active. The movement the Mouvement Breton, extremely powerful, very violent in the beginning, but now more and more established, was happening. There was the breakup of Britain at the same time. Cornwall, which has a parliament today. Scotland, of course. Tom Nairn wrote the book, and he's a member of parliament, the Scottish parliament today. And he was a sociologist, I think, right? Tom Nairn, yeah. Sociologist. Huh? Is he in Melbourne? He left the parliament. Oh, we gave up. All right. But he was in the Scottish parliament as representative for a while. Of course, there's the Ireland situation. There's Wales. These were very strong movements, and he was writing about this stuff. And they haven't really disappeared, although they go up and down. I myself got interested in this because I was doing work in Hawaii, and Hawaiians were not supposed to exist. They disappeared, they said. The beginning of the 19th century, of the 20th century, they were gone. And they did disappear in many ways. But in the mid-70s, they returned in force. People changed their names. The population doubled. American Indians, 700,000 in 1970. In 1980, almost 2 million. That's not biology. It is identity. So there were numerous identity movements. There are 500 million people who identify as indigenous today. It's organized in terms of UN representation, and there's a tremendous amount of activity going on in this direction. Migration also went through the same period of identification or re-identification. Assimilation declined. It didn't work. States couldn't afford it. Some of them even went multicultural because they couldn't afford it. It was a way of doing it cheaply, in the same way that Indians got casinos and got control over reservations. It was a cheap way out, and nobody thought it would be a problem. It became the pluralist solution to a weakened state machine or state apparatus. In Europe, it became a very strong process of re-identification, especially in the 80s when labor migration stopped. And why did labor migration stop? Because there were no jobs. And why did that happen? Because Europe was declining. The decline and the changes are connected to one another. In that decline, the fringes of Europe, because in very soon after that, you have the decline of the Soviet Empire and a fragmentation of that and an increasing fragmentation in certain zones of Europe, Central Asia and Yugoslavia, which creates massive out-migration. All the unstable areas get worse off, creating massive out-migration, which becomes immigration to Europe in a period when people are losing their jobs, which creates and has to create conflict. So there is conflict in this period, which increases. The problems haven't been solved yet. There isn't a cultural solution to these problems, it seems to me, because people have to be happy to solve their ethnic problems. And if people are unhappy, ethnicity is a good way out. It's a good way out for individuals, in the same way that new religions which emerge in this period is also a good way out. It creates a kind of, you could say, loop, which is a very dangerous one, that looks like that. There is a lumpenization in Europe. In Paris in the 80s, people talked about Los Angelization. There was a massive transformation. You could say Islamization was part of it in the late 80s and 90s. There are 5 mosques in 1980 in Paris. In 1990, there are 1,500. people who were more or less assimilated by hook or by crook, because assimilation is a very nasty process itself, suddenly became de-assimilated. They started learning Arabic. They started going to the mosque, and there was an increasing re-identification that went on. This created what's called today the dangerous suburbs, where people burn cars every year, which is supposed to be the proof that they're really French, because if you're really French, you have to burn cars. In any case, and people get sick. They feel bad. There are lots of psychic problems. There are all these narcissistic problems, especially identity crises. And that's for some people. For other people, there's a re-identification process that occurs, and they find something that they can hook into. Because having an identity that's bigger than yourself gives you a life project. And the life project can be religious, it can be sexual, it can be environmental, if you want to culturalize it can be ethnic. And these things all happen in the same period and across the board. Within, let's say, an 8 to 9 year period, you get a massive, you could say, reinvestment of individuals into collective identification, which at the higher level means fragmentation. Because you suddenly get a nation state which is full of new projects, separate projects. And there's no way of accommodating them in any simple way. And some societies like the French maintain a very strong republicanism, which doesn't really work. When I first worked in Paris, there was no such thing as ethnicity. If you read Durkheim, ethnicity is simply ideology. One of his students, the very famous, what's his name, who worked on demography, who went to Chicago, the Chicago School. Halbwachs, who went to Chicago and he came back and he wrote in Durkheim's Annales Sociologiques, saying that America is a very funny country. It's full of ethnic groups. We haven't got that here. He says it's 1922. In 1922, there was more migration in France, or migrant populations were a larger percentage of the population than in the United States. The difference was that in France, there was no such thing as ethnicity. You were more or less French. And there were some people who were less French. But they weren't ethnic in the positive sense of having an ethnic identity, at least as far as the state was concerned and as far as the sociologists were concerned. And so they weren't studied. In fact, you couldn't get money to study ethnicity until the mid-70s, when the books started coming out on a massive scale. Ethnic France, racial France, multiracial France, and so on and so forth. And today, of course, it's a large-scale phenomenon. But all of this has led to, you could say, a society in which there are lots of separate projects existing at the same time. This is part of the process of decline, even though it would be nice if it wasn't. But as far as I can see it, this is what's happening. And it tends to reproduce itself on an expanding scale unless the conditions of existence in those societies changes. And they haven't. In fact, things have been getting gradually worse. So that's one aspect of this process which I think is extremely important. And I'm jumping over a lot of stuff here because I'm supposed to be provocative and I have 7 minutes, so I'm going to get even more provocative now. The second thing that I have looked at in this is that, so you could say this, if I call this a certain kind of cultural polarization that occurs, which includes ethnic polarization, it could be religious, ethnic, it could be anything, but people are dividing up into collectivities on a smaller scale. In fact, there's one French sociologist who calls this the tribalization of France. So this is one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is the vertical polarization, which I referred to. Gini indexes are increasing, that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and there are interesting kind of transformations of elite relationships involved in this. That in this process there is something specific that goes on, which looks like this. And you can forget about the categories. These categories are not fixed. They are simply momentary, but they are also invariant in the sense that they're always there. They can be smaller, larger. They can have slightly different valences, but they seem to be reproduced all the time. But I'm interested in the reproduction of the categories. The categories themselves are not building blocks. They're not elements in a system. They are products. The process is, you could say, the tendency for the upper middle class and the upper class to get much better off and for everybody else to go downwards. And this produces a polarization which takes on increasingly interesting forms politically and, you could say, to some extent, ethnically, because what goes on in the downward end is what I call indigenization, so that people who are losing their jobs in the middle class, the lower middle class, and the working class become increasingly rooted, nationalistic, xenophobic, and people who are going upwards get increasingly cosmopolitan and want out of the state and tend to see the world in a very, very different way. And they can afford to. I don't want to name names, but I have a whole list of people who are perfect expressions of that. I'd love to talk about it because there are biographies of them now. But all of this is like is irrelevant to the process itself because it makes sense. And I'm not saying that anybody is false. Cosmopolitans are just as authentic as Indians in existential terms, and those are the only terms that count. All the rest of it is museology. I'm not interested in categorizing from the outside. So these are important phenomena and have to be understood as such. They're age-old as well. This has also taken its... It has a very strong effect on governance itself. Both in the United States and in Europe, there is a transformation in cultural representation, and that, let's say political representation or political culture, move from what used to be called the diametric version of politics to a concentric version of politics. This is why structuralism still works. Diametric can be represented simply as this: left, right. All right, there could be lots of other things in there, but the oppositions are of a diametric sort, and this is from, let's say, at least the beginning of the 19th century, and it has moved increasingly towards what I call a concentric model in which the left and right combine into a kind of respectable middle and surrounded by the iniquitous or the bad guys or the dangerous classes, which was also a tendency in the 19th century. The elites who are allowed to rule, who should rule. And this is a complex and very interesting process, I think. And that's what my research for the last year has been on. If you look at the expressions of this, you see it in the words new being used. New democracy in the United States. Clinton is a perfect example of that. There's a very good book by a couple of political scientists called Politicians Don't Pander, which is about, you could say, how to rule without having to go through all of this democratic stuff, except occasionally when you have elections, which turns into a ritual. In England, it's called New Labour. If it's a conservative party, they'll call themselves the New Conservatives, which is interesting because they're doing very similar things because they all have the same experts doing their economic forecasting and all the rest of it. And in Germany, which is the best, it's called the Neue Mitte. It is the Neue Mitte. It is the middle. This is why Tony Blair is called Thatcher without the handbag. This is why Tony Giddens was referred to as the messenger of the prince since he became Sir and was working basically for the Labour government and his think tank. His think tank and the New Democracy think tank under Clinton is the same think tank, the same people. So there's something like this going on. At the same time, is that there are people on the outside who are being accused of being undemocratic. So being outside means undemocratic. If you're not in the center parties themselves, and they're usually two, then you are an outsider and by definition undemocratic. So Haider was undemocratic. And he became undemocratic after he won 30% of the vote in Austria. And he was attacked by all of these people, like the president of France, who's about as criminal as they get in terms of politics. Not Mitterrand, but his Chirac came after him. He is on trial right now. But also on the left. So the mayor of London, 7 minutes. Well, 2 minutes. Oh, I'm never going to make it. 2 minutes. Red Ron Livingstone, who's just a Labourite, was accused of exactly the same thing. So the people out there are dangerous, undemocratic, have to be controlled. And sometimes the people are referred to in such terms. The people have to be educated. They have to be controlled. There is a report from the European Union. It's called the Green Paper on organic democracy. Organic democracy is a way to replace democracy. And then we have two components. First, we have new public management, which means you can govern directly without consulting the people as a whole. They'll say by elections. And you can criticize representative democracy as much as you want, but focus groups is not the solution, I don't think, but that's what they think. You get focus groups and you have governance. A lot of this is run by the giant firm Bertelsmann, who actually pays governments to be more efficient. But you've got that process going on. It means that elections are downplayed. The real governance in organic democracy is the corporate players, the state, capital corporations, ethnic groups, anyone that looks like a corporation of some kind and negotiates directly with the state, these are the real actors of democracy. And then you have the parliament or the election, which is reduced to a ritual role, and this is explicitly stated. Okay, so this is not just a game or in my interpretation. They say that themselves, the role of elections is basically to legitimate organic democracy. It's not there to actually do something. It's not has no direct function as such. So this takes on astounding proportions, seems to me, in the transformation of governance itself, which takes lots of different forms because it splits things. You end up with a split between what I can show here, between, you could say, respectable elites and populist outsiders, both left and right, who tend to combine in many ways. This is what happened in Holland. It's happening in most countries in France, where in Europe, where right-wing parties have between 25 and 35% of the vote. And it's become institutionalized as well. And it's an issue, a real problem, but it says something about the connections that I'm trying to get at here, because this is part of the liftoff of the state. You could even say that this is a form of a new absolutism, because in all cases, it's about governing as a sovereign, so that the people are no longer sovereign. It is the government which is sovereign and becomes increasingly like, you could say, an absolutist state for reasons that can be, I think, expressed in the fact that if you look at their salaries, the highest, the most rapidly rising salaries in Europe are political salaries, and especially people who work in the European Union who don't pay taxes. And they say things that are very close to what I'm talking about, and they're explicit about it. One in particular has even said that what we need to go back to is the Habsburgs. That was really good because we have a plural Europe. We need a plural organization. And the best plural organization is the empire. And so why not have an empire? And this is explicitly stated by people who sit in European government. So this is not simply an interpretation from my point of view. Now, just to throw this out, because I love the diagram. This is the same model of stratification applied to government, but then applied to political ideology. Is that I see what's going on today as a double polarization, in other words, in terms of class and in terms of culture, occurring at the same time, but which has today reached a global scale. And Islamism is an essential part of that. It is an intentionality. It's real. It's not the it's not just a reaction, in other words. I'm saying it is a real alternative. In fact, the only anti-globalization movement in the world is Islamism because it has the complete package. It has a different way of interpreting the world, and it has a system of governance. It has everything that you need to say the opposite. And it is global in its scope and global in its reach, you could say. And this, I think, is part of the kinds of processes that happen in periods like this. In other words, this is not going to be a solution for anything. It's not necessarily leading anywhere, but it is what happens in the period in which things stop working the way they were when you had, you could say, the normal hegemony, in which you always have some form of Orientalism. Today we have Occidentalism. That's why we have Islamism, which is, you can say, taking up the Occidentalist and putting it to work. That we are no good, we have to be replaced. And of course, with the help of lots of liberals who say, I hate myself so much that I must be fantastic. which is another aspect of the whole thing. It couldn't happen without an inside job, and a lot of this is coming from the inside. So, I'm not saying this is either bad or good. I'm saying that it's happening, and the intentions are real, and that there is a social rationality behind it. So,
Jonathan,
I'll leave it.
Thanks. Super engaging. Lots of fun. Let's continue.
I want to finish with a joke. Otherwise, it's not funny, right? All right. One example of this is also the fact that I say that that in all of this, you say indigenous peoples want out of the state. They don't want to be, well, a lot of them do. Not in Latin America. It's the opposite there. But in places like Australia and Canada and the United States, they want autonomy and sovereignty. And in Australia, there was a movement at the same time of the kind that fits into the Occidentalist movement, which was called Creative Nation, which started in the 80s. And it was about creating a multicultural Australia. And it was partly advertisement, but partly also real politics. And one guy from cultural studies, who I know very well, was asked to go out and talk to the Aborigines to get them to join. And he went there, and he talked to a guy, a very famous poet. This was in Perth. And he gave a long speech, starting off by saying, listen, you guys are already mixed up. You're already hybrids. And hybridity was a very important part of it. And he said, why don't you join this fantastic new thing that we're trying to build? And at the end, there was total silence. Because, of course, Aborigines have never had the choice to be hybrids or not. And they are very mixed up biologically, whatever that means. But they never had the choice. And this old poet got up, and this he was very nervous, he said, also. He walked up to him, to this guy, and he stared at him. And he said, in his inimitable Australian, and I can't really do it, he said, listen, mate, I'm an essentialist. And if you don't like it, you can bugger off. That's how it ends. All right, man.
I'm really curious as to how you understand the role of nationalism, and particularly given that we're here in the United States, of war in this process.
I have this division here because in the work that we've been doing in Europe, there is a republicanism in Germany, for example, which is basically nationalist and quite right-wing. In the old-fashioned sense, not in the new sense, not in the Fox, New York Times opposition. But in France, for example, there is a sovereigntism which is left-wing republicanism, which is actually the strongest form because most of the nationalists in France are not terribly republican, mostly because of the Catholic influence and other things. So I want to make it, there's a distinction, but they're, of course, very closely related in the sense that the notion of sovereignty reduced to its logical essentials is simply a statement that a population wants to and claims the right to have control over its own conditions of reproduction. That's in the strongest form, you could say. And this can take lots of forms. It can take a cultural form. It can take a contractual form. I think Habermas is a sovereigntist in many ways who would like to see the whole thing done as a contract because he's afraid of culture. Whereas nationalists have no problem, and then this has a very long history. This is why people like Sorel, he was everything. I mean, he was a Marxist, he was a fascist, he founded everything, he was a syndicalist, but he made this very interesting discovery that you couldn't unite the working class without a cultural core. And that cultural core was going to be the nation. And then you have everything else coming out of that, which is why you could say the whole, all of the movements in Europe in the teens and the 20s, which were basically socialist, corporatist, could be left or right. They went to dinner together. They were all part of the Socialist Internationals or whatever. And they got along personally very often, even if they disagreed, because they were all basically into a kind of logic of sovereignty, which is very, very powerful, and which split them as well. So there were left Nazis and right Nazis. In other words, there were racist Nazis and non-racist Nazis. Of course, there were racists everywhere. There were national Bolsheviks who were very anti-Semitic, and there were anti-nationalists, they're internationalists in the same movement. And these people like were all part of the same kind of phenomena, which was still rooted in the notion of a people somehow having control over its conditions of existence. So that's what I see as the foundation of you could say, this kind of identification that gets very strong in periods like this when people feel they're losing control of the situation which they thought they had control over. However wrong that might be, at least in terms of representations, that's what it's about.
What is your take on where the proliferation of non-governmental organizations fits into this whole reconfiguration of politics that elites and populists and whatever that you mapped out?
That's an aspect of the transformation of the global arena, which I left out explicitly for myself, at least, because it's another subject. But I should have mentioned it. And that part of the fragmentation process is the formation of what Castells calls network society, which includes all kinds of things. The way people trade, the breaking up of products and services into small and smaller bundles, securitization, but also, you could say, to the reorganization of the arms trade, the reorganization of all kinds of criminal activities, and so on and so forth, that this is part of, you could say, a fragmentation plus a recombination of fragments into larger networks on a global scale. And NGOs are a very good example of exactly that. It is the devolution of governance into a kind of, it's almost a privatization process. But if you look at most of the funding for NGOs in the world is state, which is interesting. It's like close to 90% of all the NGOs get their money from states. So it's a public devolution of functions onto smaller units. And so certain countries, for example, in Eastern Europe, Albania, I had a friend of mine who's a consultant. He's paid for by the European Union. He goes to Albania, and he's going to introduce civil society. They have a civil society program, and the NGO is supposed to do civil society. So they go there and do civil society. What's that mean? They have a course on how to become an NGO. And so they teach all these people to have NGOs, and within 2 years, there are 8,000 NGOs in Albania. There are 8,000 clans in Albania. And they're all about peace and love, but if you look at what they actually do, they buy guns. So like this is, in other words, what happens to NGOs, they get absorbed into other people's projects, and they do it, but they do it in a very interesting way. And there are certain countries like Kyrgyzstan, which wouldn't exist today if it weren't for NGOs. The whole government, the whole society is run by the fire departments, the post office, everything is run by NGOs, financed from outside. So it's a very interesting kind of like transformation of governance, fragmentation of governance via these large networks, but all connected, if you follow the hierarchy upwards, to larger financial units like the states themselves or like the European Union or whatever. So.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.